Lawrence was in no mood for company, and Hammond, who joined them to serve as translator, as yet remained stiff and unfriendly. They made an awkward and mostly silent company. Sun Kai inquired politely about their accommodations and then about their enjoyment of the country, which Lawrence answered very shortly. He could not help some suspicion that this might be some attempt at probing Temeraire's state of mind, and still more so when Sun Kai at last came, however, to the purpose for his visit.
"Long Tien Chian sends you an invitation," Sun Kai said. "She hopes you and Temeraire will take tea with her tomorrow in the 10,000 Lotus Palace in the morning before the flowers open."
"Thank you, sir, for bearing the message," Lawrence said, polite but flat. "Temeraire is anxious to know her better." The invitation could hardly be refused, though he was by no means happy to see further lures thrown out to Temeraire.
Sun Kai nodded equably. "She, too, is anxious to know more of her offspring's condition. Her judgment carries much weight with the Son of Heaven." He sipped his tea and added, "Perhaps you will wish to tell her of your nation and the respect which Lung Tien Xiang has won there."
Hammond translated this, and then added, quickly enough that Sun Kai might think it part of the translation of his own words,
"Sir, I trust you see this is a tolerably clear hint. You must make every effort to win her favour."
"I cannot see why Sun Kai would give me any advice at all in the first place," Lawrence said, after the envoy had left them again. "He has always been polite enough, but not what anyone would call friendly."
"Well, it's not much advice, is it?" Granby said. "He only said to tell her that Temeraire is happy. That's hardly something you couldn't have thought of alone, and it makes a polite noise."
"Yes, but we would not have known to value her good opinion quite so highly, or think this meeting of any particular importance," Hammond said. "No, for a diplomat he has said a great deal indeed, as much as he could, I imagine, without committing himself quite openly to us. This is most heartening," he added, with what Lawrence felt was excessive optimism, likely born of frustration.
Hammond had so far written 5 times to the Emperor's ministers to ask for a meeting where he might present his credentials. Every note had been returned unopened, and a flat refusal had met his request to go out from the island to meet the handful of other Westerners in the town.
"She cannot be so very maternal if she agreed to send him so far away in the first place," Lawrence said to Granby, shortly after dawn the next morning. He was inspecting his best coat and trousers, which he had set out to air overnight, in the early light. His cravat needed pressing, and he thought he had noticed some frayed threads on his best shirt.
"They usually aren't, you know," Granby said, "or at least not after the hatching, though they get broody over the eggs when they are first laid. Not that they don't care at all, but after all, a dragonette can take the head off a goat 5 minutes after it breaks the shell. They don't need mothering. Here, let me have that. I can't press without scorching, but I can do up a seam."
He took the shirt and needle from Lawrence and set to repairing the tear in the cuff.
"Still, she would not care to see him neglected, I'm sure," Lawrence said, "though I wonder that she is so deeply in the Emperor's council. I would have imagined that if they sent any celestial egg away, it would only have been of a lesser line. Thank you, Daya, set it there," he said as the young runner came in, bearing the hot iron from the stove.
His appearance polished so far as he could manage, Lawrence joined Temeraire in the courtyard. The striped dragon had returned to escort them. The flight was only a short one, but curious. They flew so low they could see small clumps of ivy and rootlings that had managed to establish themselves upon the yellow-tiled roofs of the palace buildings, and see the colours of the jewels upon the mandarins' hats as the ministers went hurrying through the enormous courtyards and walkways below, despite the early hour of the morning. The particular palace lay within the walls of the immense Forbidden City, easily identifiable from aloft. 2 huge dragon pavilions on either side of a long pond almost choked with water lilies, the flowers still closed within their buds. Wide, sturdy bridges spanned the pond, arched high for decoration, and a courtyard flagged with black marble lay to the south, just now being touched with first light. The yellow-striped dragon landed here and bowed them along. As Temeraire padded by, Lawrence could see other dragons stirring in the early light under the eaves of the great pavilions. An ancient celestial was creeping stiffly out from the bay farthest to the southeast, the tendrils about his jaw long and drooping as moustaches. His enormous ruff was leached of colour, and his hide gone so translucent, the black was now redly tinted with the colour of the flesh and blood beneath. Another of the yellow-striped dragons paced him carefully, nudging him occasionally with his nose towards the sun-drenched courtyard. The celestial's eyes were a milky blue, the pupils barely visible beneath the cataracts. A few other dragons emerged also, imperials rather than celestials, lacking the ruff and tendrils, and with more variety in their hue. Some were as black as Temeraire, but others a deep indigo-washed blue. All very dark, however, except for Lien, who emerged at the same time out of a separate and private pavilion set back and alone among the trees, and came to the pond to drink. With her white hide, she looked almost unearthly among the rest. Lawrence felt it would be difficult to fault anyone for indulging in superstition towards her, and indeed the other dragons consciously gave her a wide berth. She ignored them entirely in return, and yawned wide and red, shaking her head vigorously to scatter away the clinging drops of water, and then paced away into the gardens in solitary dignity. Qian herself was waiting for them at one of the central pavilions, flanked by two imperial dragons of particularly graceful appearance, all of them adorned with elaborate jewels. She inclined her head courteously, and flicked a talon against a standing bell nearby to summon servants. The attending dragons shifted their places to make room for Lawrence and Temeraire on her right, and the human servants brought Lawrence a comfortable chair. Qian made no immediate conversation, but gestured towards the lake. The line of the morning sun was now travelling swiftly northward over the water as the sun crept higher, and the lotus buds were unfolding in almost balletic progression. They numbered literally in the thousands, and made a spectacle of glowing pink colour against the deep green of their leaves. As the last unfurled flowers came to rest, the dragons all tapped their claws against the flagstones in a clicking noise, a kind of applause. Now a small table was brought for Lawrence, and great porcelain bowls painted in blue and white for the dragons, and a black, pungent tea poured for them all. To Lawrence's surprise, the dragons drank with enjoyment, even going so far as to lick up the leaves in the bottom of their cups. He himself found the tea curious and overstrong in flavour, almost the aroma of smoked meat, though he drained his cup politely as well. Temeraire drank his own enthusiastically and very fast, and then sat back with a peculiar, uncertain expression, as though trying to decide whether he had liked it or not.
"You have come a very long way," Qian said, addressing Lawrence. An unobtrusive servant had stepped forward to her side to translate. "I hope you are enjoying your visit with us, but surely you must miss your home."
"An officer in the king's service must be used to go where he is required, madam," Lawrence said, wondering if this was meant as a suggestion. "I have not spent more than a 6 month at my own family's home since I took ship the first time, and that was as a boy of 12."
"That is very young to go so far away," Qian said. "Your mother must have had great anxiety for you."
"She had the acquaintance of Captain Mountjoy, with whom I served, and we knew his family well," Lawrence said, and seized the opening to add, "You yourself had no such advantage, I regret, on being parted from Temeraire. I would be glad to satisfy you on whatever points I might, if only in retrospect."
She turned her head to the attending dragons.
"Perhaps Mei and Shu will take Xiang to see the flowers more closely," she said, using Temeraire's Chinese name.
The two imperials inclined their heads and stood up expectantly, waiting for Temeraire. Temeraire looked a little worriedly at Lawrence and said,
"They are very nice from here."
Lawrence felt rather anxious himself at the prospect of a solitary interview, with so little sense of what might please Qian. But he mustered a smile for Temeraire and said,
"I will wait here with your mother. I am sure you will enjoy them."
"Be sure not to bother Grandfather or Lien,"
Qian added to the imperial dragons, who nodded as they led Temeraire away. The servants refilled his cup and Qian's bowl from a fresh kettle, and she lapped at it in a more leisurely way. Presently she said,
"I understand Temeraire has been serving in your army."
There was unmistakably a note of censure in her voice, which did not need translation.
"Among us, all those dragons who can serve in defence of their home. That is no dishonour, but the fulfilment of our duty," Lawrence said. "I assure you we could not value him more highly. There are very few dragons among us. Even the least are greatly prized, and Temeraire is of the highest order.
She rumbled low and thoughtfully.
Why are there so few dragons that you must ask your most valued to fight?
We are a small nation, nothing like your own, Lawrence said. Only a handful of smaller wild breeds were native to the British Isles when the Romans came and began to tame them. Since then, by cross-breeding, our lines have multiplied, and thanks to careful tending of our cattle herds, we have been able to increase our numbers. But still we cannot support nearly so many as you here possess.
She lowered her head and regarded him keenly.
And among the French, how are dragons treated?
Instinctively, Lawrence was certain British treatment of dragons was superior, and more generous than that of any other Western nation, but he was unhappily aware he would have considered it also superior to China's, if he had not come and already seen plainly otherwise. A month before, he could easily have spoken with pride of how British dragons were cared for. Like all of them, Temeraire had been fed and housed on raw meat and in bare clearings, with constant training and little entertainment. Lawrence thought he might as well brag of raising children in a pigsty to the Queen, as speak of such conditions to this elegant dragon in her flower-decked palace. If the French were no better, they were hardly worse, and he would have thought very little of anyone who covered the faults in his own service by blackening another's.
"In ordinary course, the practices in France are much the same as ours, I believe," he said at last. "I do not know what promises were made you, in Temeraire's particular case, but I can tell you that Emperor Napoleon himself is a military man. Even as we left England, he was in the field, and any dragon who was his companion would hardly remain behind while he went to war."
"You are yourself descended from kings, I understand,"
Jian said unexpectedly, and turning her head spoke to one of the servants, who hurried forward with a long rice-paper scroll and unrolled it upon the table. With amazement, Lawrence saw it was a copy, in a much finer hand and larger, of the familial chart which he had drawn so long ago at the New Year banquet.
"This is correct?" she inquired,
seeing him so startled. It had never occurred to him that the information would come to her ears, nor that she would find it of interest, but he at once swallowed any reluctance. He would puff off his consequence to her day and night if it would win her approval.
"My family is indeed an old one, and proud. You see, I myself have gone into service in the corps, and count it an honour," he said, though guilt pricked at him. Certainly no one in the circles of his birth would have called it as much.
Qian nodded, apparently satisfied, and sipped again at her tea while the servant carried the chart away again. Lawrence cast about for something else to say.
"If I may be so bold, I think I may with confidence say on behalf of my government that we would gladly agree to whatever conditions the French accepted on your first sending Temeraire's egg to them."
"Many considerations besides remain," was all she said in response to this overture, however.
Temeraire and the two Imperials were already coming back from their walk, Temeraire having evidently set a rather hurried pace. At the same time, the White Dragon came walking past as she returned to her own quarters, with Yong Xing now by her side, speaking with her in a low voice, one hand affectionately resting upon her side. She walked slowly, so he could keep pace, and also the several attendants, trailing reluctantly after, burdened with large scrolls and several books. Still the Imperials held well back, and waited to let them pass, before coming back into the pavilion.
"Qian? Why is she that colour?" Temeraire asked, peeking back out at Lien after she had gone by. "She looks so very strange." "Who can understand the workings of heaven?"
Qian said repressively.
"Do not be disrespectful. Lien is a great scholar. She was Chuang Yuan many years ago, though she did not need to submit to the examinations at all, being a celestial, and also she is your elder cousin. She was sired by Chu, who was hatched of Xian, as was I."
"Oh," Temeraire said, abashed. More timidly, he asked,
"Who was my sire?"
"Long Qin Gao,"
Qian said, and twitched her tail. She looked rather pleased by the recollection.
"He is an Imperial dragon, and is at present in the south in Hangzhou. His companion is a prince of the third rank, and they are visiting the West Lake."
Lawrence was startled to learn celestials could so breed true with Imperials, but on his tentative inquiry Qian confirmed as much.
That is how our line continues. We cannot breed among ourselves, she said, and added, quite unconscious of how she was staggering him, there are only myself and Lien now who are female. And besides grandfather and Chu, there are only Chuan and Ming and Ji. And we are all cousins at most.
Only 8 of them, altogether? Hammond stared, and sat down blankly, as well he might. I don't see how they can possibly continue on like that forever, Granby said. Are they so mad to keep them only for the Emperor's that they'll risk losing the whole line?
Evidently, from time to time, a pair of Imperials will give birth to a Celestial, Lawrence said between bites. He was sitting down at last to his painfully late dinner in his bedroom. 7 o'clock, and full darkness outside, and he had swelled himself near to bursting with tea in an effort to stave off hunger over the visit, which had stretched to many hours.
That is how the oldest fellow there now was born, and he is sire to the lot of them, going back 4 or 5 generations.
I cannot make it out in the least, Hammond said, paying no attention to the rest of the conversation. 8 Celestials. Why on earth would they ever have given him away? Surely, at least for breeding. I cannot credit it. Bonaparte cannot have impressed them so, not second-hand and from a continent away. There must be something else, something which I have not grasped. Gentlemen, you will excuse me, he added distractedly, and rose and left them alone.
Lawrence finished his meal without much appetite and set down his chopsticks.
She did not say no to our keeping him, at any rate, Granby said into the silence, but dismally.
Lawrence said after a moment, more to quell his own inner voices,
I could not be so selfish to even try and deny him the pleasure of making the better acquaintance of his own kindred, or learning about his native land.
It is all stuff and nonsense in the end, Lawrence, Granby said, trying to comfort him. A dragon won't be parted from his captain for all the gems in Araby, and all the calves in Christendom too, for that matter.
Lawrence rose and went to the window. Temeraire had curled up for the night upon the heated courtyard stones once again. The moon had risen, and he was very beautiful to look at in the silver light, with the blossom, heavy trees on either side hanging low above him, and a dappled reflection in the pond, all his scales gleaming.
That is true. A dragon will endure a great deal sooner than be parted from his captain. It does not follow that a decent man would ask it of him,
Lawrence said, very low, and let the curtain fall. Chapter 14 Temeraire himself was quiet the day after their visit. Lawrence went out to sit with him and gazed at him with anxiety, but he did not know how to broach the subject of what distressed him, nor what to say. If Temeraire was grown discontented with his lot in England and wished to stay, there was nothing to be done. Hammond would hardly argue so long as he was able to complete his negotiations. He cared a good deal more for establishing a permanent embassy and winning some sort of treaty than for getting Temeraire home. Lawrence was by no means inclined to force the issue early. Chian had told Temeraire on their departure to make himself free of the palace, but the same invitation had not been extended to Lawrence. Temeraire did not ask permission to go, but he looked wistfully into the distance and paced the courtyard in circles, and refused Lawrence's offer to read together. At last, growing sick of himself, Lawrence said, "Would you wish to go and see Chian again? I am sure she would welcome your visit."
"She did not ask you," Temeraire said, but his wings fanned halfway out, irresolute.
"There can be no offence intended in a mother liking to see her offspring privately," Lawrence said. And this excuse was sufficient. Temeraire very nearly glowed with pleasure and set off at once. He returned only late that evening, jubilant and full of plans to return.
"They have started teaching me to write," he said. "I have already learned 25 characters today. Shall I show you?"
"By all means," Lawrence answered, and not only to humour him. Grimly he set himself to studying the symbols Temeraire laid down, and copying them down as best he could with a quill instead of a brush, while Temeraire pronounced them for his benefit, though he looked rather doubtful at Lawrence's attempts to reproduce the sounds. He did not make much progress, but the effort alone made Temeraire so very happy that he could not begrudge it, and concealed the intense strain which he had suffered under the entire seeming endless day. Infuriatingly, however, Lawrence had to contend not only with his own feelings, but with Hammond on the subject as well.
One visit in your company could serve as reassurance and give her the opportunity of making your acquaintance, the diplomat said. But this continued solitary visiting cannot be allowed. If he comes to prefer China and agrees of his own volition to stay, we will lose any hope of success. They will pack us off at once.
That is enough, sir, Lawrence said angrily. I have no intention of insulting Temeraire by suggesting that his natural wish to become acquainted with his kind in any way represents a lack of fidelity.
Hammond pressed the point, and the conversation grew heated. At last, Lawrence concluded by saying,
If I must make this plain, so be it. I do not consider myself as under your command. I have been given no instructions to that effect, and your attempt to assert an authority without official foundation is entirely improper.
Their relations had already been tolerably cool. Now they became frigid, and Hammond did not come to have dinner with Lawrence and his officers that night. The next day, however, he came early into the pavilion, before Temeraire had left on his visit, accompanied by Prince Yongxing.
"His Highness has been kind enough to come and see how we do. I am sure you will join me in welcoming him," he said, with rather hard emphasis on the last words, and Lawrence rather reluctantly rose to make his most formal leg.
"You are very kind, sir. As you see, you find us very comfortable," he said with stiff politeness and wary.
He still did not trust Yongxing's intentions in the least. Yongxing inclined his head a very little, equally stiff and unsmiling, and then turned and beckoned to a young boy following him, no more than 13 years of age, wearing wholly nondescript garments of the usual indigo-dyed cotton. Glancing up at him, the boy nodded and walked past Lawrence directly up to Temeraire, and made a formal greeting. He raised his hands up in front of himself, fingers wrapped over one another, and inclined his head, saying something in Chinese at the same time. Temeraire looked a little puzzled, and Hammond interjected hastily.
"Tell him yes, for heaven's sake."
"Oh," said Temeraire, uncertainly, but said something to the boy, evidently affirmative. Lawrence was startled to see the boy climb up onto Temeraire's foreleg and arrange himself there. Yongxing's face was, as always, difficult to read, but there was a suggestion of satisfaction to his mouth. Then he said,
"We will go inside and take tea," and turned away.
"Be sure not to let him fall,"
Hammond added hastily to Temeraire, with an anxious look at the boy, who was sitting cross-legged with great poise, and seemed as likely to fall off as a Buddha statue to climb off its pediment.
"Roland,"
Lawrence called. She and Dyer had been working their trigonometry in the back corner.
"Pray see if he would like some refreshment."
She nodded and went to talk to the boy in her broken Chinese, while Lawrence followed the other men across the courtyard and into the residence. Already the servants had hastily rearranged the furniture, a single draped chair for Yongxing with a footstool, and armless chairs placed at right angles to it for Lawrence and Hammond. They brought the tea with great ceremony and attention, and throughout the process Yongxing remained perfectly silent. Nor did he speak once the servants had at last withdrawn, but sipped at his tea very slowly. Hammond at length broke the silence with polite thanks for the comfort of their residence and the attentions which they had received.
"The tour of the city in particular was a great kindness. May I ask, sir, if it was your doing?"
Yongxing said,
"It was the Emperor's wish. Perhaps, Captain,"
he added,
"you were favourably impressed?"
It was very little a question, and Lawrence said shortly,
"I was, sir. Your city is remarkable."
Yongxing smiled, a small dry twist of the lips, and did not say anything more, but then he scarcely needed to. Lawrence looked away, all the memory of the Coverts in England and the bitter contrast fresh in his mind. They sat in dumb show a while longer. Hammond ventured again,
"May I inquire as to the Emperor's health? We are most eager, sir, as you can imagine, to pay the King's respects to His Imperial Majesty and to convey the letters which I bear."
"The Emperor is in Chengde," Yongxing said dismissively. "He will not return to Peking soon. You will have to be patient."
Lawrence was increasingly angry. Yongxing's attempt to insinuate the boy into Temeraire's company was as blatant as any of the previous attempts to separate the two of them, and yet now Hammond was making not the least objection, and still trying to make polite conversation in the face of insulting rudeness. Pointedly, Lawrence said,
"Your Highness's companion seems a very likely young man. May I inquire if he is your son?"
Yongxing frowned at the question and said only,
"No," coldly.
Hammond, sensing Lawrence's impatience, hastily intervened before Lawrence could say anything more.
"We are, of course, only too happy to attend the Emperor's convenience, but I hope we may be granted some additional liberty, if the wait is likely to be long, at least as much as has been given the French ambassador. I am sure, sir, you have not forgotten their murderous attack upon us at the outset of our journey, and I hope you will allow me to say once again that the interests of our nations march far more closely together than yours with theirs."
Unchecked by any reply, Hammond went on. He spoke passionately and at length about the dangers of Napoleon's domination of Europe, the stifling of the trade which should otherwise bring great wealth to China, and the threat of an insatiable conqueror spreading his empire ever wider. Perhaps, he added, ending on their very doorstep.
"For Napoleon has already made one attempt, sir, to come at us in India, and he makes no secret that his ambition is to exceed Alexander. If he should ever be successful, you must realize his rapacity will not be satisfied there."
The idea that Napoleon should subdue Europe, conquer the Russian and the Ottoman empires both, cross the Himalayas, establish himself in India, and still have energy left to wage war on China, was to Lawrence a piece of exaggeration that would hardly convince anyone. And as for trade, he knew that argument carried no weight at all with Yong Xing, who had so fervently spoken of China's self-sufficiency. Nevertheless, the prince did not interrupt Hammond at all from beginning to end, listened to the entire long speech, frowning, and then at the end of it, when Hammond concluded with a renewed plea to be granted the same freedoms as de Guigne, Yong Xing received it in silence, sat a long time, and then said only,
"You have as much liberty as he does. Anything more would be unsuitable."
"Sir," Hammond said, "perhaps you are unaware that we have not been permitted to leave the island, nor to communicate with any official even by letter."
"Neither is he permitted," Yong Xing said. "It is not proper for foreigners to wander through Peking, disrupting the affairs of the magistrates and the ministers. They have much to occupy them."
Hammond was left baffled by this reply. Confusion writ plain on his face, and Lawrence, for his part, had sat through enough. Plainly, Yong Xing meant nothing but to waste their time while the boy flattered and fawned over Temeraire. As the child was not his own son, Yong Xing had surely chosen him from his relations, especially for great charm of personality, and instructed him to be as insinuating as ever he might. Lawrence did not truly fear that Temeraire would take a preference to the boy, but he had no intention of sitting here playing the fool for the benefit of Yong Xing's scheming.
"We can't be leaving the children unattended this way," he said abruptly. "You will excuse me, sir," and rose from the table, already bowing.
As Lawrence had suspected, Yong Xing had no desire to sit and make conversation with Hammond except to provide the boy an open field, and he rose also to take his leave of them. They returned altogether to the courtyard, where Lawrence found, to his private satisfaction, that the boy had climbed down from Temeraire's arm, and was engaged in a game of jacks with Roland and Dyer, all of them munching on ship's biscuit, and Temeraire had wandered out to the pier to enjoy the breeze coming off the lake. Yong Xing spoke sharply, and the boy sprang up with a guilty expression. Roland and Dyer looked equally abashed, with glances towards their abandoned books.
"We thought it was only polite to be hospitable,"
Roland said hurriedly, looking to see how Lawrence would take this.
"I hope he has enjoyed the visit," Lawrence said mildly, to their relief. "Back to your work now."
They hurried back to their books, and, the boy called to heel, Yong Xing swept away with a dissatisfied mien, exchanging a few words with Hammond in Chinese. Lawrence gladly watched him go.
"At least we may be grateful that de Guigne is as restricted in his movements as we are," Hammond said after a moment. "I cannot think Yong Xing would bother to lie on the subject, though I cannot understand how—"
He stopped in puzzlement and shook his head.
"Well, perhaps I may learn a little more tomorrow."
"I beg your pardon," Lawrence said,
and Hammond absently said, "He said he would come again at the same time. He means to make a regular visit of it."
"He may mean whatever he likes," Lawrence said angrily,
at finding Hammond had thus meekly accepted further intrusions on his behalf.
"But I will not be playing attendance on him. And why you should choose to waste your time cultivating a man you know very well has not the least sympathy for us is beyond me."
Hammond answered with some heat,
"Of course Yong Xing has no natural sympathy for us. Why should he, or any other man here? Our work is to win them over, and if he is willing to give us the chance to persuade him, it is our duty to try, sir. I am surprised that the effort of remaining civil and drinking a little tea should so try your patience."
Lawrence snapped. "And I am surprised to find you so unconcerned over this attempt at supplanting me after all your earlier protests."
"What, with a 12-year-old boy?"
Hammond said, so very incredulous it was nearly offensive.
"I, sir, in my turn, am astonished at your taking alarm now. And perhaps if you had not been so quick to dismiss my advice before, you should not have so much need to fear."
"I do not fear in the least," Lawrence said. "But neither am I disposed to tolerate so blatant an attempt, or to have us submit tamely to a daily invasion whose only purpose is to give offence."
"I will remind you, Captain, as you did me not so very long ago, that just as you are not under my authority, I am not under yours," Hammond said. "The conduct of our diplomacy has very clearly been placed in my hands, and thank heaven. If we were relying upon you, by now I dare say you would be blithely flying back to England, with half our trade in the Pacific sinking to the bottom of the ocean behind you."
"Very well. You may do as you like, sir," Lawrence said. "But you had best make plain to him that I do not mean to leave this protégé of his alone with Temeraire any more, and I think you will find him less eager to be persuaded afterwards. And do not imagine," he added, "that I will tolerate having the boy let in where my back is turned, either."
"As you are disposed to think me a liar, and an unscrupulous schemer, I see very little purpose in denying I should do any such thing,"
Hammond said angrily, colouring up. He departed instantly, leaving Lawrence still angry, but ashamed and conscious of having been unfair. He would himself have called it grounds for a challenge. By the next morning, when from the pavilion he saw Yong Shing going away with the boy, having evidently cut short the visit on being denied access to Temeraire, his guilt was sharp enough that he made some attempt to apologize, with little success. Hammond would have none of it.
"Whether he took offence at your refusing to join us, or whether you were correct about his aims, can make no difference now," he said very coldly. "If you will excuse me, I have letters to write,"
and so quitted the room. Lawrence gave it up, and instead went to say farewell to Temeraire, only to have his guilt and unhappiness both renewed at seeing in Temeraire's manner an almost furtive excitement, a very great eagerness to be gone. Hammond was hardly wrong. The idle flattery of a child was nothing to the danger of the company of Qian and the Imperial Dragons, no matter how devious Yong Xing's motives or how sincere Qian's. There was only less honest excuse for complaining of her. Temeraire would be gone for hours, but the house being small, and the chambers separated mainly by screens of rice paper, Hammond's angry presence was nearly palpable inside, so Lawrence stayed in the pavilion after he had gone, attending to his correspondence, unnecessarily, as it was now 5 months since he had received any letters, and little of any interest had occurred since the welcoming dinner party, now 2 weeks old. He was not disposed to write of the quarrel with Hammond. He dozed off over the writing and woke rather abruptly, nearly knocking heads with Sun Kai, who was bending over him and shaking him.
"Captain Lawrence, you must wake up," Sun Kai was saying.
Lawrence said automatically, "I beg your pardon, what is the matter?" and then stared. Sun Kai had spoken in quite excellent English, with an accent more reminiscent of Italian than Chinese.
"Good Lord, have you been able to speak English all this time?" he demanded, his mind leaping to every occasion on which Sun Kai had stood on the dragon deck, privy to all their conversations, and now revealed as having understood every word. "There is no time at present for explanations," Sun Kai said. "You must come with me at once. Men are coming here to kill you, and all your companions also."
It was near on 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and the lake and trees framed in the pavilion doors were golden in the setting light. Birds were speaking occasionally from up in the rafters where they nested. The remark, delivered in perfectly calm tones, was so ludicrous Lawrence did not at first understand it, and then stood up in outrage.
"I'm not going anywhere in response to such a threat, with so little explanation," he said, and raised his voice. "Granby!"
"Everything all right, sir?"
Blythe had been occupying himself in the neighbouring courtyard on some busy work, and now poked his head in, even as Granby came running.
"Mr. Granby, we are evidently to expect an attack," Lawrence said. "As this house does not admit of much security, we will take the small pavilion to the south with the interior pond, establish a lookout, and let us have fresh locks in all the pistols."
"Very good,"
Granby said, and dashed away again. Blythe, in his customary silence, picked up the cutlasses he had been sharpening, and offered Lawrence one before wrapping up the others and carrying them with his whetstone to the pavilion. Sun Kai shook his head.
"This is great foolishness," he said, following after Lawrence. "The very largest gang of Hun Hun are coming from the city. I have a boat waiting just here, and there is time yet for you and all your men to get your things and come away."
Lawrence inspected the pavilion entryway. As he had remembered, the pillars were made of stone rather than wood and nearly 2 feet in diameter, very sturdy, and the walls of a smooth grey brick under their layer of red paint. The roof was of wood, which was a pity, but he thought the glazed tile would not catch fire easily.
"Blythe, will you see if you can arrange some elevation for Lieutenant Riggs and his riflemen out of those stones in the garden? Pray assist him, Willoughby, thank you."
Turning around, he said to Sun Kai,
"Sir, you have not said where you would take me, nor who these assassins are, nor whence they have been sent. Still less have you given us any reason to trust you. You have certainly deceived us so far as your knowledge of our language. Why you should so abruptly reverse yourself, I have no idea, and after the treatment which we have received, I am in no humour to put myself into your hands."
Hammond came with the other men, looking confused, and came to join Lawrence, greeting Sun Kai in Chinese.
"May I inquire what is happening?" he asked stiffly.
"Sun Kai has told me to expect another attempt at assassination," Lawrence said. "See if you can get anything more clear from him. In the meantime, I must assume we are shortly to come under attack and make arrangements. He can speak perfect English," he added. "You need not resort to Chinese."
He left Sun Kai with a visibly startled Hammond, and joined Riggs and Granby at the entryway.
"If we could knock a couple of holes in this front wall, we could shoot down at any of them coming," Riggs said, tapping the brick. "Otherwise, sir, we're best off laying down a barricade mid-room and shooting as they come in. But then we can't have fellows with swords at the entryway."
"Lay and man the barricade," Lawrence said. "Mr. Granby, block as much of this entryway as you can, so they cannot come in more than three or four abreast, if you can manage it. We will form up the rest of the men to either side of the opening, well clear of the field of fire, and hold the door with pistols and cutlasses between volleys, while Mr. Riggs and his fellows reload."
Granby and Riggs both nodded.
"Right you are," Riggs said. "We have a couple of spare rifles along, sir. We could use you at the barricade."
This was rather transparent, and Lawrence treated it with the contempt which it deserved.
"Use them for second shots as you can. We cannot waste the guns in the hands of any man who is not a trained rifleman."
Keynes came in almost staggering under a basket of sheets, with three of the elaborate porcelain vases from their residence laid on top.
"You are not my usual kind of patients," he said, "but I can bandage and splint you at any rate. I will be in the back by the pond. And I have brought these to carry water in," he added, sardonic, jerking his chin at the vases. "I suppose they would bring £50 each in auction, so let that be an encouragement not to drop them."
"Roland, Dyer, which of you is the better hand at reloading?" Lawrence asked. "Very well, you will both help Mr. Riggs for the first three volleys. Then, Dyer, you are to help Mr. Keynes, and run back and forth with the water jugs as that duty permits."
"Lawrence,"
Granby said in an undertone when the others had gone, "I don't see any sign of all those guards anywhere, and they have always been used to patrol at this hour. They must have been called away by someone." Lawrence nodded silently and waved him back to work.
"Mr. Hammond, you will pray go behind the barricade," he said as the diplomat came to his side,
Sun Kai with him.
"Captain Lawrence, I beg you to listen to me," Hammond said urgently. "We had much better go with Sun Kai at once. These attackers, he expects, are young bannermen, members of the Tatar tribes, who from poverty and lack of occupation have gone into a sort of local brigandage, and there may be a great many of them."
"Will they have any artillery?" Lawrence asked,
paying no attention to the attempt at persuasion.
"Cannon? No, of course not. They do not even have muskets," Sun Kai said. "But what does that matter? There may be 100 of them or more, and I have heard rumours that some among them have even studied Shaolin Chuan in secret, though it is against the law. And some of them may be, however distantly, kin to the Emperor," Hammond added. "If we were to kill one, it could easily be used as a pretext for taking offence and casting us out of the country. You must see we ought to leave at once."
"Sir, you will give us some privacy,"
Lawrence said to Sun Kai flatly, and the envoy did not argue, but silently bowed his head and moved some distance away.
"Mr. Hammond," Lawrence said, turning to him, "you yourself warned me to beware of attempts to separate me from Temeraire. Now only consider, if he should return here to find us gone, with no explanation and all our baggage gone also, how should he ever find us again? Perhaps he might even be convinced that we had been given a treaty and left him deliberately behind as Yong Shing once desired me to do.
"'And how will the case be improved if he returns and finds you dead and all of us with you?' Hammond said impatiently. "'Sun Kai has before now given us cause to trust him.'
"'I give less weight to a small piece of inconsequential advice than you do, sir, "'and more to a long and deliberate lie of omission. "'He has unquestionably spied on us from the very beginning of our acquaintance,' Lawrence said. "'No, we are not going with him. "'It will not be more than a few hours before Temeraire returns, "'and I am confident in our holding out that long.'
"'Unless they have found some means of distracting him "'and keeping him longer at his visit,' Hammond said. "'If the Chinese government meant to separate us from him, "'they could have done so by force at any time during his absence. "'I am sure Sun Kai can arrange to have a message "'sent to him at his mother's residence "'once we have gone to safety.'
"'Then let him go and send the message now, if he likes,' Lawrence said. "'You are welcome to go with him.'
"'No, sir,' Hammond said, flushing, "'and turned on his heel to speak with Sun Kai.'
The former envoy shook his head and left, and Hammond went to take a cutlass from the ready heap. They worked for another quarter of an hour, hauling in three of the queer-shaped boulders from outside to make the barricade for the riflemen, and dragging over the enormous dragon couch to block off most of the entryway. The sun had gone by now, but the usual lanterns did not make their appearance around the island, nor any signs of human life at all.
"Sir,"
Digby hissed suddenly, pointing out into the grounds.
2 points to starboard, outside the doors of the house.
Away from the entry, Lawrence said.
He could not see anything in the twilight, but Digby's young eyes were better than his.
Willoughby, douse that light.
The soft click-click of the guns being cocked, the echo of his own breath in his ears, the constant, untroubled hum of the flies and mosquitoes outside. These were at first the only noise, until use filtered them out and he could hear the light running footsteps outside. A great many men, he thought. Abruptly there was a crash of wood, several yells.
"'They've broken into the house, sir!'
Hackley whispered hoarsely from the barricades.
"'Quiet there!'
Lawrence said. And they kept a silent vigil while the sound of breaking furniture and shattering glass came from the house. The flare of torches outside cast shadows into the pavilion, weaving and leaping in strange angles as a search commenced. Lawrence heard men calling to each other outside, the sound coming down from the eaves of the roof. He glanced back. Riggs nodded and the three riflemen raised their guns. The first man appeared in the entrance and saw the wooden slab of the dragon couch blocking it.
"'My shot!'
Riggs said clearly, and fired. The Chinaman fell dead with his mouth open to shout. But the report of the gun brought more cries from outside, and men came bursting in with swords and torches in their hands. A full volley fired off, killing another three, then one more shot from the last rifle, and Riggs called, "'Prime and reload!' The quick slaughter of their fellows had checked the advance of the larger body of men, and clustered them in the opening left in the doorway. Yelling, "'Temeraire!' and "'England!' the aviators launched themselves from the shadows and engaged the attackers close at hand. The torchlight was painful to Lawrence's eyes after the long wait in the dark, and the smoke of the burning wood mingled with that from the musketry. There was no room for any real sword play. They were engaged hilt to hilt, except when one of the Chinese swords broke. They smelled of rust, and a few men fell over. Otherwise they were all simply heaving back against the pressure of dozens of bodies trying to come through the narrow opening. Digby, being too slim to be of much use in the human wall, was stabbing at the attackers between their legs, their arms, through any space left open.
"'My pistols!'
Lawrence shouted at him. No chance to pull them free himself. He was holding his cutlass with two hands, one upon the hilt and the other laid upon the flat of the blade, keeping off three men. They were packed so close together they could not move either way to strike at him, but could only raise and lower their swords in a straight line, trying to break his blade through sheer weight. Digby pulled one of the pistols out of its holster and fired, taking the man directly before Lawrence between the eyes. The other two involuntarily pulled back, and Lawrence managed to stab one in the belly, then seized the other by the sword arm and threw him to the ground. Digby put a sword into his back, and he lay still.
"'Present arms!'
Riggs yelled from behind, and Lawrence bellowed,
"'Clear the door!'
He swung a cut at the head of the man engaged with Granby, making him flinch back, and they scrambled back together, the polished stone floor already slick under their boot heels. Someone pushed the dripping jug into his hand. He swallowed a couple of times and passed it on, wiping his mouth and his forehead against his sleeve. The rifles all fired at once, and another couple of shots after. Then they were back into the fray. The attackers had already learned to fear the rifles, and they had left a little clear space before the door, many milling about a few paces off under the torches. They nearly filled the courtyard before the pavilion. Sun Kai's estimate had not been exaggerated. Lawrence shot a man 6 paces away, then flipped the pistol in his hand. As they came rushing back on, he clubbed another in the side of the head, and then he was again pushing back against the weight of the swords until Riggs shouted again.
"Well done, gentlemen," Lawrence said, breathing deeply.
The Chinese had retreated at the shout and were not immediately at the door. Riggs had experience enough to hold the volley until they advanced again.
"For the moment the advantage is ours. Mr. Granby, we will divide into 2 parties. Stay back this next wave, and we shall alternate. Theroux, Willoughby, Digby with me, Martin, Blythe, and Hammond with Granby."
"I can go with both, sir," Digby said. "I'm not tired at all, truly. It's less work for me, since I can't help to hold them."
"Very well, but be sure to take water between and stay back on occasion," Lawrence said. "There are a damned lot of them, as I dare say you have all seen," he said candidly. "But our position is a good one, and I have no doubt we can hold them as long as ever need be, so long as we pace ourselves properly."
"And see Canes at once to be tied up if you take a cut or a blow. We cannot afford to lose anyone to slow bleeding,"
Granby added to this, while Lawrence nodded.
"Only sing out and someone will come to take your place in line."
A sudden, feverish, many-voiced yell rose from outside, the men working themselves up to facing the volley, then a pounding of running feet, and Riggs shouted, "Fire!" as the attackers stormed the entryway again. The fighting at the door was a greater strain now, with fewer of them to hand, but the opening was sufficiently narrow that they could hold it even so. The bodies of the dead were forming a grisly addition to their barrier, piled now 2 and even 3 deep, and some of the attackers were forced to stretch over them to fight. The reloading time seemed queerly long, an illusion. Lawrence was very glad of the rest, when at last the next volley was ready. He leaned against the wall, drinking again from the vase. His arms and shoulders were aching from the constant pressure, and his knees.
"Is it empty, sir?"
Dyer was there, anxious, and Lawrence handed him the vase. He trotted away back towards the pond through the haze of smoke shrouding the middle of the room. It was drifting slowly upwards into the cavernous emptiness above. Again the Chinese did not immediately storm the door, with the volley waiting. Lawrence stepped a little way back into the pavilion and tried to look out, to see if he could make anything out beyond the front line of the struggle. But the torches dazzled his eyes too much. Nothing but an impenetrable darkness beyond the first row of shining faces, staring intently towards the entryway, feverish with the strain of battle. The time seemed long. He missed the ship's glass and the steady telling of the bell. Surely it had been an hour or two by now. Temeraire would come soon. A sudden clamour from outside and a new rhythm of clapping hands. His hand went without thought to the cutlass hilt. The volley went off with a roar.
"For England and the King!"
Granby shouted and led his group into the fray. But the men at the entry were drawing back to either side, Granby and his fellows left standing uneasily in the opening. Lawrence wondered if maybe they had some artillery after all, but instead, abruptly, a man came running at them down the open aisle alone, as if intent on throwing himself onto their swords. They stood set, waiting. Not 3 paces distant, he leapt into the air, landed somehow sideways against the column, and sprang off it literally over their heads, diving and tucked himself neatly into a rolling somersault along the stone floor. The manoeuvre defied gravity more thoroughly than any skylarking Lawrence had ever seen done. 10 feet into the air and down again with no propulsion but his own legs. The man leapt up at once, unbruised, now at Granby's back, with the main wave of attackers charging the entryway again.
"Theroux! Willoughby!"
Lawrence bellowed to the men in his group. Unnecessarily, they were already running to hold him back. The man had no weapon, but his agility was beyond anything. He jumped away from their swinging swords in a manner that made them seem accomplices in a stage play, rather than in deadly earnest trying to kill him. And from his greater distance, Lawrence could see he was drawing them steadily back, towards Granby and the others, where their swords could only become dangers to their comrades. Lawrence clapped onto his pistol and drew it out. His hands followed the practiced sequence despite the dark and the furor. In his head he listened to the chant of the great gun exercise, so nearly parallel. Ramrod down the muzzle with a rag twice, and then he pulled back the hammer to half-cocked, groping after the paper cartridge in his hip pouch. Theroux suddenly screamed and fell, clutching his knee. Willoughby's head turned to look. His sword was held defensively at the level of his chest, but in that one moment of incaution the Chinese man leapt again impossibly high and struck him full on the jaw with both feet. The sound of his neck snapping was grisly. He was lifted an inch straight up off the ground, arms splaying out wide, and then collapsed into a heap, his head lolling side to side upon the ground. The Chinese man tumbled to the ground from his leap, landed on his shoulder, rolling lightly back up, and turned to look at Lawrence. Riggs was yelling from behind him, "Make ready! Faster, damn you! Make ready!" Lawrence's hands were still working, tearing open the cartridge of black powder with his teeth, a few grains like sand bitter on his tongue. Powder straight down the muzzle, then the round lead ball after, the paper in for wadding, rammed down hard, no time to check the primer, and he raised the gun and blew out the man's brains, barely more than arm's reach away. Lawrence and Granby dragged Theros back over to Kane's while the Chinese backed away from the waiting volley. He was sobbing quietly, his leg dangling useless.
"I'm sorry, sir," he kept saying, choked.
"For heaven's sake, enough moan," Kane's said sharply, when they put him down and slapped Theros across the face with a distinct lack of sympathy. The young man gulped, but stopped, and hastily scrubbed an arm across his face.
"The kneecap is broken," Kane's said after a moment. "A clean enough break, but he won't be standing again for a month."
"Get over to Riggs when you have been splinted and reload for them," Lawrence told Theros. Then he and Granby dashed back to the entryway. "We'll take rest by turns," Lawrence said, kneeling down by the others. "Hammond, you first. Go and tell Riggs to keep one rifle back, loaded, at all times, if they should try and send another fellow over that way." Hammond was visibly heaving for breath, his cheeks marked with spots of bright red. He nodded and said hoarsely,
"Leave your pistols. I will reload."
Blythe, gulping water from the vase, abruptly choked, spat out a fountain, and yelled,
"Sweet Christ in heaven!"
and made them all jump. Lawrence looked around wildly. A bright orange goldfish, 2 fingers long, was wriggling on the stones in the puddled water.
"Sorry,"
Blythe said, panting. "I felt the bugger squirming in my mouth." Lawrence stared, then Martin started laughing, and for a moment they were all grinning at one another. Then the rifles cracked off, and they were back to the door. The attackers made no attempt at setting the pavilion on fire, which surprised Lawrence. They had torches enough, and wood was plentiful around the island. They did try smoke, building small bonfires to either side of the building under the eaves, but through either some trick of the pavilion's design, or simply the prevailing wind, a drifting air current carried the smoke up and out through the yellow-tiled roof. It was unpleasant enough, but not deadly, and near the pond the air was fresh. Each round the one man resting would go back there to drink and clear his lungs and have the handful of scratches they had all by now accumulated smeared with salve and bound up if still bleeding. The gang tried a battering ram, a fresh-cut tree with the branches and leaves still attached, but Lawrence called,
"Stand aside as they come and cut at their legs."
The bearers ran themselves directly onto the blades with great courage, trying to break through, but even the 3 steps that led up to the pavilion door were enough to break their momentum. Several at the head fell with gashes, showing bone, to be clubbed to death with pistol butts, and then the tree itself toppled forward and halted their progress. The British had a few frantic minutes of hacking off the branches to clear the view for the riflemen. By then the next volley was more than ready, and the attackers gave up the attempt. After this, the battle settled into a sort of grisly rhythm. Each round of fire won them even more time to rest now, the Chinese evidently disheartened by their failure to break in through the small British line, and by the very great slaughter. Every bullet found its mark. Riggs and his men had been trained to make shots from the back of a dragon, flying sometimes at 30 knots in the heat of battle, and with less than 30 yards to the entryway they could scarcely miss. It was a slow, grinding way to fight, every minute seeming to consume 5 times its proper length. Lawrence began to count the time by volleys.
"We'd better go to 3 shots only a volley, sir,"
Riggs said, coughing, when Lawrence knelt to speak with him, his next rest spell.
"It'll hold them all the same, now they've had a taste, and though I brought all the cartridges we had, we're not bloody infantry. I have Theros making us more, but we have enough powder for another 30 rounds at most, I think."
"That will have to do," Lawrence said. "We will try and hold them longer between volleys. Start resting 1 man every other round also."
He emptied his own cartridge box and Granby's into the general pile. Only another 7, but that meant 2 rounds more at least, and the rifles were of more value than the pistols. He splashed his face with water at the pond, smiling a little at the darting fish, which he could see more clearly now, his eyes perhaps adjusting to the dark. His neckcloth was soaked quite through with sweat. He took it off and wrung it out over the stones, then could not bring himself to put it back on once he had exposed his grateful skin to the air. He rinsed it clean and left it spread out to dry, then hurried back. Another measureless stretch of time, the faces of the attackers growing blurry and dim in the doorway. Lawrence was struggling to hold off a couple of men, shoulder to shoulder with Granby, when he heard Dyer's high treble cry out, "Captain! Captain!" from behind. He could not turn and look. There was no opportunity for pause.
"I have them!"
Granby panted, and kicked the man in front in the balls with his heavy Hessian boot. He engaged the other hilt to hilt, and Lawrence pulled away and turned hurriedly around. A couple of men were standing dripping on the edge of the pond, and another pulling himself out. They had somehow found whatever reservoir fed the pond and swum through it underneath the wall. Keynes was sprawled unmoving on the floor, and Riggs and the other riflemen were running over, still reloading frantically as they went. Hammond had been resting. He was swinging furiously at the two other men, pushing them back towards the water, but he did not have much science. They had short knives and would get under his guard in a moment. Little Dyer seized one of the great vases and flung it, still full of water, into the man bending over Keynes's body with his knife. It shattered against his head and knocked him down to the floor, dazed and slipping in the water. Roland, running over, snatched up Keynes's tenaculum and dragged the sharp, hooked end across the man's throat before he could arise, blood spurting in a furious jet from the severed vein through his grasping fingers. More men were coming out of the pond.
"Fire at will!"
Riggs shouted, and three went down, one of them shot with only his head protruding from the water, sinking back down below the surface in a spreading cloud of blood. Lawrence was up beside Hammond, and together they forced the two he was struggling against back into the water. While Hammond kept swinging, Lawrence stabbed one with the point of his cutlass, and clubbed the other with the hilt. He fell unconscious into the water, open-mouthed, and bubbles rose in a profusion from his lips.
"Push them all into the water!" Lawrence said. "We must block up the passage!"
He climbed into the pond, pushing the bodies against the current. He could feel a greater pressure coming from the other side, more men trying to come through.
"Riggs, get your men back to the front and relieve Granby," he said. "Hammond and I can hold them here."
"I can help also,"
Theroux said, limping over. He was a tall fellow and could sit down on the edge of the pond and put his good leg against the mass of bodies.
"Roland, Dyer, see if there is anything to be done for Keynes,"
Lawrence said over his shoulder, and then looked when he did not hear a response immediately. They were both being sick in the corner, quietly. Roland wiped her mouth and got up, looking rather like an unsteady-legged foal.
"Yes, sir,"
she said, and she and Dyer tottered over to Keynes. He groaned as they turned him over. There was a great clot of blood on his head above the eyebrow, but he opened his eyes dazedly as they bound it up. The pressure on the other side of the mass of bodies weakened and slowly ceased. Behind them the guns spoke again and again with suddenly quickened pace, Riggs and his men firing almost at the rate of redcoats. Lawrence, trying to look over his shoulder, could not see anything through the haze of smoke.
"Theroux and I can manage! Go!"
Hammond gasped out. Lawrence nodded and slogged out of the water, his full boots dragging like stones. He had to stop and pour them out before he could run to the front. Even as he came, the shooting stopped. The smoke so thick and queerly bright they could not see anyone through it, only the broken heap of bodies around the floor at their feet. They stood waiting, Riggs and his men reloading more slowly, their fingers shaking. Then Lawrence stepped forward, using a hand on the column for balance. There was nowhere to stand but on the corpses. They came out blinking through the haze into the early morning sunlight, startling up a flock of crows that lifted from the bodies in the courtyard and fled, shrieking hoarsely, over the water of the lake. There was no one left moving in sight. The rest of the attackers had fled. Martin abruptly fell over onto his knees, his cutlass clanging unmusically on the stones. Granby went to help him up and ended by falling down also. Lawrence groped to a small wooden bench before his own legs gave out. Not caring very much that he was sharing it with one of the dead, a smooth-faced young man with a trail of red blood drying on his lips and a purple stain around the ragged bullet wound in his chest. There was no sign of Temeraire. He had not come. Chapter 15 Sun Kai found them scarcely more than dead themselves an hour later. He had come warily into the courtyard from the pier with a small group of armed men, perhaps 10 or so, and formally dressed in guard uniforms, unlike the scruffy and unkempt members of the gang. The smouldering bonfires had gone out of their own accord for lack of fuel. The British were dragging the corpses into the deepest shade, so they would putrefy less horribly. They were all of them half-blind and numb with exhaustion and could offer no resistance. Helpless to account for Temeraire's absence and with no other idea of what to do, Lawrence submitted to being led to the boat, and thence to a stuffy, enclosed palanquin, whose curtains were drawn tight around him. He slept instantly upon the embroidered pillows, despite the jostling and shouts of their progress, and knew nothing more until at last the palanquin was set down and he was shaken back to wakefulness.
"Come inside," Sun Kai said, and pulled on him until he rose.
Hammond and Granby and the other crewmen were emerging in similarly dazed and battered condition from other sedan chairs behind him. Lawrence followed unthinking up the stairs into the blessedly cool interior of a house, fragrant with traces of incense, along a narrow hallway and to a room which faced onto the garden courtyard. There he at once surged forward and leapt over the low balcony railing. Temeraire was lying curled asleep upon the stones.
"Temeraire!"
Lawrence called and went towards him. Sun Kai exclaimed in Chinese and ran after him, catching his arm before he could touch Temeraire's side. Then the dragon raised up his head and looked at them, curiously, and Lawrence stared. It was not Temeraire at all. Sun Kai tried to drag Lawrence down to the ground, kneeling down himself. Lawrence shook him off, managing with difficulty to keep his balance. He noticed only then a young man of perhaps 20, dressed in elegant silk robes of dark yellow embroidered with dragons, sitting on a bench. Hammond had followed Lawrence and now caught at his sleeve.
"For God's sake, kneel!" he whispered. "This must be Prince Mianning, the Crown Prince."
He himself went down to both knees and pressed his forehead to the ground, just as Sun Kai was doing. Lawrence stared a little stupidly down at them both, looked at the young man and hesitated. Then he bowed deeply instead, from the waist. He was mortally certain he could not bend a single knee without falling down to both, or more ignominiously upon his face, and he was not yet willing to perform the kowtow to the Emperor, much less the Prince. The Prince did not seem offended, but spoke in Chinese to Sun Kai. He rose, and Hammond also, very slowly.
"He says we can rest here safely," Hammond said to Lawrence. "I beg you to believe him, sir. He can have no need to deceive us."
Lawrence said, "Will you ask him about Temeraire?" Hammond looked at the other dragon blankly.
"That is not him," Lawrence added. "It is some other celestial. It is not Temeraire."
Sun Kai said, "Long Tian Xiang is in seclusion in the Pavilion of Endless Spring. A messenger is awaiting to bring him word as soon as he emerges."
"He is well?" Lawrence asked,
not bothering to try and make sense of this. The most urgent concern was to understand what might have kept Temeraire away.
"There is no reason to think otherwise," Sun Kai said, which seemed evasive.
Lawrence did not know how to press him further. He was too thick with fatigue. But Sun Kai took pity on his confusion and added more gently,
"He is well. We cannot interrupt his seclusion, but he will come out some time today, and we will bring him to you then."
Lawrence still did not understand, but he could not think of anything else to do at the moment.
"Thank you,"
he managed.
"Pray thank His Highness for his hospitality, for us. Pray convey our very deep thanks. I beg he will excuse any inadequacy in our address."
The Prince nodded and dismissed them with a wave. Sun Kai herded them back over the balcony into their rooms, and stood watching over them until they had collapsed upon the hard wooden bed platforms. Perhaps he did not trust them not to leap up and go wandering again. Lawrence almost laughed at the improbability of it, and fell asleep mid-thought.
"Lawrence! Lawrence!"
Temeraire said, very anxiously. Lawrence opened his eyes and found Temeraire's head poked in through the balcony doors and a darkening sky beyond.
"Lawrence, you are not hurt?"
"Oh!" Hammond had woken and fallen off his bed in startlement at finding himself cheek to jowl with Temeraire's muzzle.
"Good God!"
he said, painfully climbing to his feet and sitting back down upon the bed.
I feel like a man of 80, with gout in both legs."
Lawrence sat up with only a little less effort. Every muscle had stiffened up during his rest.
"No, I'm quite well," he said,
reaching out gratefully to put a hand on Temeraire's muzzle and feel the reassurance of his solid presence.
"You have not been ill?"
He did not mean it to sound accusing, but he could hardly imagine any other excuse for Temeraire's apparent desertion, and perhaps some of his feeling was clear in his tone. Temeraire's ruff drooped.
"No," he said miserably. "No, I am not sick at all."
He volunteered nothing more, and Lawrence did not press him, conscious of Hammond's presence. Temeraire's shy behaviour did not bode a very good explanation for his absence, and as little as Lawrence might relish the prospect of confronting him, he liked the notion of doing so in front of Hammond even less. Temeraire withdrew his head to let them come out into the garden. No acrobatic leaping this time. Lawrence levered himself out of bed and stepped slowly and carefully over the balcony rail. Hammond, following, was almost unable to lift his foot high enough to clear the rail, though it was scarcely 2 feet off the ground. The prince had left, but the dragon, whom Temeraire introduced to them as Lung Tien Chuan, was still there. He nodded to them politely, without much interest, then went straight back to work upon a large tray of wet sand, in which he was scratching symbols with a talon. "Writing poetry," Temeraire explained. Having made his bow to Chuan, Hammond groaned again as he lowered himself onto a stool, muttering under his breath with a degree of profanity more appropriate to the seaman from whom he had likely first heard the oaths. It was not a very graceful performance, but Lawrence was perfectly willing to forgive him that and more after the previous day's work. He had never expected Hammond to do as much, untrained, untried, and in disagreement with the whole enterprise.
"If I may be so bold, sir, allow me to recommend you take a turn around the garden instead of sitting," Lawrence said. "I have often found it answer well."
"I suppose I had better," Hammond said, and after a few deep breaths heaved himself back up to his feet, not disdaining the offer of Lawrence's hand, and walking very slowly at first. But Hammond was a young man. He was already walking more easily after they had gone halfway round. With the worst of his pain relieved, Hammond's curiosity revived. As they continued walking around the garden, he studied the two dragons closely, his steps slowing as he turned first from one to the other and back. The courtyard was longer than it was wide. Stands of tall bamboo and a few smaller pine trees clustered at the ends, leaving the middle mostly open, so the two dragons lay opposite each other, head to head, making the comparison easier. They were indeed as like as mirror images, except for the difference in their jewels. Chuan wore a net of gold draped from his ruff down the length of his neck, studded with pearls. Very splendid, but it looked likely to be inconvenient in any sort of violent activity. Temeraire had also battle scars, of which Chuan had none. The round knot of scales on his breast from the spiked ball, now several months old, and the smaller scratches from other battles. But these were difficult to see, and aside from these the only difference was a certain undefinable quality in their posture and expression, which Lawrence could not have adequately described for another's interpretation. "Can it be chance?" Hammond said. "All celestials may be related, but such a degree of similarity. I cannot tell them apart."
"We are hatched from twin eggs," Temeraire said, lifting up his head as he overheard this. "Chuan's egg was first, and then mine."
"Oh! I have been unutterably slow," Hammond said, and sat down limply on the bench. "Lawrence! Lawrence!"
His face was almost shining from within, and he reached out, groping towards Lawrence, and seized his hand and shook it.
"Of course! Of course! They did not want to set up another prince as a rival for the throne. That is why they sent away the egg. My God, how relieved I am!"
"Sir, I hardly dispute your conclusions, but I cannot see what difference it makes to our present situation," Lawrence said, rather taken aback by this enthusiasm.
"Do you not see?" Hammond said. "Napoleon was only an excuse, because he is an emperor on the other side of the world, as far away as they could manage from their own court. And all this time I have been wondering how the devil de Guigne ever managed to approach them when they would scarcely let me put my nose out of doors. Ha! The French have no alliance, no real understanding with them at all!"
"That is certainly cause for relief," Lawrence said. "But their lack of success does not seem to me to directly improve our position. Plainly the Chinese have now changed their minds,
and desire Temeraire's return.
No, do you not see? Prince Mianing still has every reason to want Temeraire gone, if he could render another claimant eligible for the throne, Hammond said. Oh, this makes all the difference in the world. I have been groping in the dark. Now I have some sense of their motives, a great deal more comes clear. How much longer will it be until the allegiance arrives? He asked suddenly, looking up at Lawrence.
I know too little about the likely currents and the prevailing winds in the Bay of Jitao to make any accurate estimate, Lawrence said, taken aback. A week at least, I should think.
I wish to God Staunton were here already. I have 1,000 questions and not enough answers, Hammond said. But I can at least try and coax a little more information from Sun Kai. I hope he will be a little more forthright now. I will go and seek him. I beg your pardon.
At this, he turned and ducked back into the house. Lawrence called after him belatedly,
Hammond, your clothes!
For his breeches were unbuckled at the knee, they and his shirt hideously blood-stained besides, and his stockings thoroughly laddered. He looked a proper spectacle. But it was too late. He had gone.